You're listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, with service members from across the military sharing their stories of combat and survival. And now, here's your host, Mark Zeno.
Welcome into the Hazard Ground Podcast. As always, we appreciate you joining us each and every week. A great episode coming up with a United States congressman. And full disclosure, before we get to the episode, we recorded it prior to Election Day. And good news for our guest, he was reelected. So you may hear him reference that his election is coming up. So just be cognizant of the fact that we did record it prior to Election Day. Once again, a reminder, as the United States keeps turning and tumultuous times still seem to be ahead, let's make sure as veteran service members, we're continuing to set the example and continuing to show unity, continuing to show that we are a force together, and that's what makes us better and stronger. Just a couple of notes before we get to this week's episode. Reminder about all of our social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Make sure you follow us on all of them. Subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. Check out the website, hazardground.com. Click on that Amazon button at the bottom of the homepage or under the sponsors tab, and whatever you spend, we'll get a percentage of that, and we'll donate that right back to some of the great charities you've heard featured here on the Hazard Ground. And of course, I say this a lot, but I can't say it enough. I do want to take a quick moment to say thank you to all of our listeners. Guys, we couldn't do this without you. You guys are such a big part of why this podcast is so successful and why we continue to do what we do every week, because we know that there's an audience out there that is loving these stories and is loving the people who are telling them. So once again, thank you for continuing to support us, supporting the show, and continuing to support veterans and service members all over the globe. And without further ado, let's get on to this week's episode. Joining us this week on the podcast is a very special guest. He is currently a colonel in the Army National Guard, still serving. He is also a Green Beret with multiple deployments to Afghanistan and the Middle East to his credit. He has also authored a book called Warrior Diplomat, A Green Beret's Battles from Washington to Afghanistan. As well, he is currently a United States congressman serving in the 6th Congressional District in the state of Florida. He is Congressman Michael Waltz joining us here on the Hazard Ground Podcast. Congressman, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, brother. Good to be with you, man, and great podcast that you have going, and thanks for your service in the Guard.
Well, thank you, sir. And again, it's a pleasure to have you on. You know, it's funny. I first came across your name, and I want to hear about this part of your career later on, but I first came across your name watching the HBO documentary called Manhunt, which was the sort of CIA version of how they found Osama bin Laden. And you were in Afghanistan on a very eventful and fateful night back in the, I want to say it was the end of 2009 or 10.
Nine.
Was it? Nine?
Okay, yeah, it was nine. That's right.
So, I mean, that's when I first came across your name and I started studying your career. And then, of course, you get elected to Congress. And I'm like, this is a guy that I certainly want to talk to. But let's start back at the beginning and tell me how and why you got in the military.
Oh, gosh, it's one of those things that, you know, I never really thought of anything else. I was that kid who, you know, in his library, literally read every history book in the entire section. Right. I could tell you about Yamamoto, and I could spot the difference between a P-47, P-51 and a P-38 probably at six. So where that came from, you know, I don't know. It's in the genes. I'm a Navy brat, but I never really knew my father. I was raised by just an incredible, fantastic, and very strong single mom, and really kind of, and she embodied the American dream. You know, we really had nothing. I remember having to sell my toys at a flea market, so we had grocery money. Wow. And she busted through ceiling after ceiling after ceiling, starting as literally a clerk and then eventually retiring as an executive vice president for Prudential Securities, 32 years of just grinding it out. You know, it took her 15 years to graduate school, and took me four. We graduated the same year. So, I don't know, man. I've always had a real just appreciation for what this country's all about, for its history, how exceptional it is in the world. You know, and really, I had some fantastic teachers along the way. One, I remember kind of walking us through. He was talking about the 4th of July, and I've never forgotten it, that, you know, how truly unique this country was with its Declaration of Independence and then its Constitution, that every other country in the world, emperors, czars, kings and queens, they granted rights down to its citizens, and whatever they didn't grant, the monarchy came for them. And how our founding father kept for them, our founding fathers turned that on its head, and that rights were granted to the people, and what the people decided was then granted to government. And so I think defending this republic from all enemies, foreign and domestic, is righteous work and something that I've always had in my heart and in my soul.
You ended up going to VMI. Was that by design? Did you want to go to West Point, or what was the reason for that?
You know, I was fascinated by part of it was the visits. I put in applications to West Point, Citadel. I knew I wanted to go to a military school, but something struck me when I visited VMI. Again, I think part of it was my priest. My childhood priest was a VMI grad. Never really knew my dad. So he was kind of a father figure to me. I think that had something to do with it. And I'll never forget in the visit, sitting down, you know, when they have you go around and talk to other cadets and professors. I talked to a professor that was the number two running the resistance to the Soviet Union and to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. He was a former CIA officer. And, never in a million years did I think, fast forwarding a decade, that I would be doing a lot of what he did, and just something drew me there, brother. And I got to tell you, it's like running a marathon. I'm proud I did it. I don't know that I would do it again. Getting the crap beat out of you for 4 years, it was kind of like being at mile 19 of the marathon going, what the hell am I doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I always joked around with I joked around with lieutenants on active duty, cause I was ROTC. I'm like, yeah, I get the same paycheck you did, but I got a college experience. You got misery.
Oh, I know. You know, when I remember I went to Officer Basic, and I'm sitting next to somebody from Florida State and somebody else from, they're talking about how much they missed it. And I'm talking about how, thank God I got the heck out of there. But, at the end of the day, I'm very proud I did it. It's just a totally unique and historic institution.
Now, did you branch infantry or combat arms?
I went armor.
Okay.
Yeah, went armor and was a tanker. But I learned once, and all of our armor guys out there, that it's a lot of fun when you're riding the top of that tank as a lieutenant, first lieutenant, captain. But man, I think in many ways you become kind of a glorified logistician to keep those beasts running after that. And I was fascinated, this was in the 90s. I was just kind of fascinated always by the diversity of the mission with Special Forces, that you could find yourself 1 week doing, back then it was kind of demining and Haiti style peacekeeping. But at the same time, they were rounded up war criminals in the Balkans. It really is kind of the PhD of warfare, that unconventional mindset of like what we did in helping the Mujahideen topple the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And all of those pieces.
So when did you first start the SF process? I mean, did you go right as a lieutenant, or did somebody bring it to you, or how does that whole thing unfold?
A friend of mine brought to me. So I got out actually just before 9/11.
Okay.
And 9/11 happened. And one of the frustrations, though, being in the 90s is I remember we had to get a one-star general's permission to start our tanks. Funding was so tight.
Yeah.
I used to take my platoon out and practice our formations in golf carts that I would just pay for, out on the golf course. And we would try not to wreck the place, but we would practice our different formations in golf carts because the military was just so difficult. I'll just leave it at that under Clinton.
Well, no, listen, I've talked about it all the time. I tell this story often that, I graduated from college in 99. So when I did ROTC, I was going right to active duty. That was the deal back then. There weren't handing out like National Guard or Reserve commissions, unless you were a SMP cadet. But, all my college classmates were going to the job fair and they said, hey, Mark, you going to the job fair? And I'm like, no. And they're like, why? And I'm like, because I have to go in the Army. And their response was, well, why don't you get a real job? Right. Because I remember I got off active duty just prior to 9/11 because the military was downsizing as such. They were actually kicking people off of right. active duty officers off and sending them to the Guard and the Reserves because they were downsizing so much in the late 90s during the Clinton administration. And again, that's not a political statement. That's just a fact. The reasons behind it are a political discussion that we don't need to have at this point in time. But, you know, that was just what was happening. So I'm kind of right there with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And got recruited out. But 9/11 happened and that changed everything.
Same,
so,
yeah.
you know, and at the same time, a former buddy of mine that an artillery guy had gone special forces, and he exposed me to this whole world called the reserve component that both SEALs and Green Berets have, reserve component units. The Green Berets are in the Guard. You got to go through all the same training. So I you know, got sucked back in and, finished up my training. You know, it so happened to be that my Guard unit was deployed and over in Afghanistan at the same time. But we knocked all that out. And then, you know, finally, after, again, getting the snot beat out of me, got, you know, finally donned that Green Beret.
Now, what state were you in for the Guard at this time?
Maryland.
Okay.
Maryland at this point. Yep. It was Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion of 20th Special Forces.
Yeah, my first, you know, 6-7 years in the Guard were in Maryland, so it's we're crossing paths here, ships in the night. But that said, how long did it take you to go through the entire SF process, assessment, selection, and the Q course as a Guardsman? Because it's, you know, on the active duty, they can bump you right back to back, and you knock it out fairly quickly. How long was it?
Rather than going back and forth like a lot of people in the Guard have to do because we were mobilized, I was able to get a lot of it knocked out. I had to do selection twice, got hurt the first time right towards the end, so that was brutal to do that twice. But I'd been through Ranger school already. I was one of the rare armor guys that had his Ranger tab. And so, you know, I knew that basically I could lead under intense pain because that's basically what Ranger school teaches you. It's a leadership course at the end of the day. But can you do it when you haven't slept, eaten, and everybody else around you is delirious, right? You know, where do you get that gut check? Mm-hmm. But I was able to get through in about a year and a half. Fortunately, I was able to test out of Spanish. I studied abroad in Spain. I escaped VMI for one semester and went to the Spanish beaches and kind of got it all out of my system. And so that's a huge component. I mean, if you're taking, you know, obviously Mandarin or Arabic, that could add another,
oh yeah,
you know, 8-9 months if you're able to test out quickly. So about a year and a half, I was able to get it all done.
So it sounds like about 75% of your military career to this point is you getting your ass kicked.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
It feels like my, you know, now I'm in politics, so it just feel like a masochist.
All right. So you finish all the training for SF. How quickly do you get to a deployment?
So here's where it got really interesting, right? Is I came off of duty. I was able to take a quick hop over to, you know, K2 over in Uzbekistan and just help with some staff work. But I get off of duty and what next? And through some mentors was introduced to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Counter-Narcotics in the Pentagon. And she was looking for someone to help stand up all of our operations against the opium trade in Afghanistan. You know, we had successfully overthrown the Taliban. We'd pushed Al-Qaeda. Now we know that we just pushed them into Pakistan, but at least we had defeated their immediate ability to attack us. But we couldn't have then this new Afghanistan turn into a narco state. So I came on in the Pentagon as a policy advisor to help stand that up, everything that we were doing over there to combat the drug trade. And that's what started this kind of fascinating back and forth that I ended up writing a book about that only a reservist could really pull off. And there I was helping craft the overall strategy. Then I would mobilize and actually have to be the only jerk in Washington to actually have to go do it with my butt on the line. Mm-hmm. So you better make sure it's right. So I did that for about a year and a half and standing up all of those programs. We had a lot of old gray beards in the office that had done Plan Columbia and what we had done to buy with and through Special Forces style to help defeat the FARC. And we didn't want that to replicate with the Taliban in Afghanistan, or at least we wanted to try to get ahead of it. And then I went out there, mobilized, and went out and took a special forces team out, gosh, in late 2005.
All right. So, I mean, you start to break ground in the political arena at this point in time. I mean, again, I don't want to fast forward too much, but did you realize what you were setting yourself up for at the time?
Oh, in terms of being a member of Congress? No idea.
Okay. That wasn't even a thought in your mind at this point?
Never in a million years. Okay. You know, maybe at some point sitting in one of those positions in the Pentagon where, you know, you can, you know, put your finger on the scales in terms of our defense policy, perhaps. But at that point, man, I mean, we were just in the throes of the war on terror. Iraq had just, you know, really taken kind of a nosedive in terms of that effort.
Yeah.
And it was just all hands on deck for the country.
The other part of this is that's interesting. You know, I talk to a lot of Green Berets, and we have a bunch here on the pod. But, you know, most people who sign up for that career in the military do so because they want to be called up to the majors, right? So to speak, like you can train all you want, but, you know, the SF guys and the SEALs, those are the guys who are first one kicking down doors and bringing bad guys to justice. You're sitting here doing this counter-narcotics thing. Do you feel like you're almost not using your skill set for what it's for?
Oh, no. I absolutely felt like I was. I mean, that's, again, I think the more sophisticated, I like to think, you know, give the SEALs a little bit of a hard time, approach that we bring. You know, I'm crafting a strategy to go after the Taliban's funding, to go after their, you know, how are they financing their operations? 90% of the world's opium and eventually heroin come out of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We'll never be able to defeat them as long as they have that kind of funding stream. And getting the authorities, I mean, what was great was, you know, when I did go downrange, I had a deep understanding of what the strategy was intended to be. I was in the room with Secretary Rumsfeld and eventually Secretary Gates, and then eventually the president, when they were saying, hey, this is the direction we need to go. So to be able to go out and execute that, I thought gave me a real leg up. And then vice versa, to come back, this is when it got really interesting, come back and say, hey, boss, obviously, I was in the room. I helped write the slides when you said this is the direction we're going to go. I was just out on the ground for a year, and we're doing the exact opposite. And that's really what formed the basis of the book is what are those disconnects between the kind of macro strategic intent and then how things get so goobered up on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, listen, that's another topic we hit on often just because even the best laid plans, right? I mean, it's one of those things where the old Mike Tyson adage, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. And it's the same thing. Everybody has a plan until the first bullet flies. And all of a sudden, you know, diplomacy isn't part of the conversation anymore. And so it's interesting from that standpoint. So your first deployment is more of this sort of strategic assessment as opposed to kicking down doors and things of that nature?
Oh, no. I was fully tactical.
It was all direct action?
Led a Green Beret. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Led a Green Beret team out there. But at that time in Afghanistan, you know, again, it's all about kind of that moment in history. We began transitioning over to NATO and kind of a NATO lead, and everything was about coalition efforts. So I ended up dividing up my team into liaison elements for the various special forces that were coming in, French SOF, Czech SOF. You know, I could go down the list of the various elements, the British, the Canadians. Because for reasons I can explain, put myself personally with the United Arab Emirates, with Arab SOF. They had a Jordanian element with them as well. But for that entire tour, it was me, just three of us, a medic and a communications sergeant, embedded with over 100 Arabs, partnered with several hundred Afghans. So, I mean, I was as close to a Lawrence of Arabia as I'm going to probably get in my career. If I never eat goat again, I'll be fine. But we were out there, I mean, you know, turban on, beard, local garb, you know, the full program. However, I have to tell you from a strategic messaging standpoint, I mean, they were good. They were pretty good. They certainly had their issues tactically. I have to be one of the only officers in the Army that had been fired at by a Taliban machine gun at the same time as Coalition 50 cals and Mark 19s. Fortunately, I was able to bring all of our guys out of that one, except we lost a couple of the of our Afghans. But strategically, to be standing in a room or to be standing in front of a village shura with an Afghan officer, an American officer, and a Arab officer, and for the Arab to say, "This is not the way. Look at what we've done in Dubai. Look at what we've done in Istanbul. You know, this is not the correct teachings of Islam, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, they're out to lunch. This, you know, and look what, and the other piece was, look what the Americans have done for Germany. Look what they've done for Japan. Look what they've done around the world." That coming from an Arab officer to the Afghan villagers was gold. So it was much broader than just going in and kicking in a door and finding the local Taliban warlord.
Afghanistan was a different place in 05. I mean, I was with Fifth Group then in Iraq, and that was a much more hot spot. You know, the level of violence and everything was completely different. Did you feel like, as far as what the soft guys were doing, that the mission there had a bigger purpose? Like, 'cause in Iraq, you know, we always felt like, look, there was so many more things to do as opposed to Afghanistan. And I only spent a couple of weeks in Afghanistan. I never had an extended time there on ground, but I always remember thinking that, as much as it looked like it was a calmer environment, I almost never wanted to go there. Like I felt like I had more control, even though it was more violent in Iraq than the unknowns of Afghanistan.
At that point, the violence hadn't risen, you know, a few years later. And when I went back in 2009, the violence was at kind of, you know, peak Iraq levels. But at that point in 05, 06, it wasn't yet, but it was just beginning to take a turn for the worse. The Taliban had completely reconstituted in its sanctuary in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge piece. But I think the real difference was in Iraq, you were never more than a few blocks or a few kilometers away from another supporting unit, plenty of resources, plenty of air cover. Yeah. In Afghanistan, look, I mean, at that tour, there were maybe 20, 30 of us in the province of Helmand. A few years later, there were over 20,000 Marines in the same province. So at that point, you were very alone and very afraid often. Like I said, I mean, medevac would be hours and hours away. Air support would sometimes take over an hour to get to you, even if you were in a pretty heated firefight. And because we were so isolated, and that tour, we were in some type of firefight almost every day in that fighting season.
Did you feel?
I mean, it was daily.
I mean,
and again, when there's only three of you,
that's
right. And we were getting indications that the Taliban had a mole inside. Believe me, we were on 33% security for the entire tour.
That's insane.
Do you
get on the ground there and you look around? I always wonder, I mean, you know, having been there, I understand why no one's ever been able to conquer that place. Did you ever get a sense of kind of the mission you were doing, as much as it was having an effect, was never, you know, you could operationally win a battle, but strategically lose the war. Did you get that sense?
Well, you know, it's tough. You have mixed feelings. I mean, obviously the enemy chose its place well, right?
Right.
But I'm of the mind of just because it's hard, just because it's been difficult, just because it's expensive, doesn't mean it wasn't worth doing and isn't still worth doing. So I think that we are going to have some type of sustained presence there for the foreseeable future. I've talked to the president about the current president about this, of course, President Bush. I get the frustration. Believe me, I don't want to see another soldier come home. In a body bag, of course. But at the same time, I think it would be absolutely tragic to pull our forces out too soon, have these groups regrow again, which they absolutely will and are trying to do, frankly, right now as we speak, hit the United States again, and then for us to have to fight our way back in after having abandoned our partners. So just as we've had we've had a presence in South Korea. We still have a presence in Colombia. We've had a presence in the Philippines. You can walk around the world. As long as half the terrorist groups in the world exist in that border region, I think we're going to have some type of presence there, fighting that fight forward while the Afghan security forces slowly build. Does that mean we're putting, you know, I-95 type highways all over the country and nation building? No. But I just really don't think we can walk away. And in terms of progress, there has been progress. It's been difficult and slow. But if you look at that younger generation now that is much more educated, you know, much more tech savvy, you know, reaching out to the world through the internet, then they truly do want a better future. We've got to kind of cast some of those old warlords aside, those old corrupt and brutal warlords aside. And I do think eventually, you know, you're not going to have Switzerland, but you could have kind of a, you know, I don't know, for lack of a better term, a Bolivia, right? I mean, you can have a stable country that isn't a direct threat to the United States. Right, so or a launching ground for a threat to the United States.
Mm-hmm. You get home from this first deployment. You don't go back again until 2009. So what's happening in the interim, both on the civilian side and the military side for you?
Yeah, well, I came back in 2006 and then became the director for Afghan policy in the Pentagon. So not just the counter-narcotics piece, but the overall you know, military policy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And then I went over and was Vice President Cheney's advisor for South Asia and counterterrorism. So that's where I ended civilian-wise. But again, and at the end of the administration, we had a strategic review because we knew that we were rapidly losing ground in Afghanistan. And I write about this in the book, to President Bush's credit, he said, look, I'm taking all your recommendations on board. I hear you that we need a major shift. But if I announce it, the incoming Obama administration at that point, he had won the election, will probably cast it aside just because they'll be under political pressure. Let's quietly hand this good work over to them. And that eventually became the surge into Afghanistan to try to, you know, prevent the bottom from falling out. But I knew as we were doing that, I was going to have to deploy as part of that. Mm-hmm. And I went over as a commander of a special forces company. So six teams, we had a SEAL team attached to us as well, and all of the enablers. So it became basically a mini task force. This was now 2009. I mean, I literally walked out of the White House Situation Room January 19th, 2009, the day before the inauguration, and a few months later, I was back on the ground in Khost Province on the border of Pakistan.
All right. So at this point, what, you're in your late 20s, and you're sitting
mid 30s.
Mid 30s. Okay, you look good.
Yeah, thanks.
But you're having conversations with the President of the United States, the kid who just wanted to go serve his country. Did he ever think that this would be a conversation he'd be having?
Oh, not in a million years. I kept waiting. You know, I mean, look, I grew up on kind of the redneck poor side of Jacksonville, Florida. Again, the only one in my family to go to college. I kept waiting on the Secret Service to knock on the door while I'm talking to the vice president or president and say, all right, buddy, you know, like, game's up. We're on to you. You don't deserve to be here. No, but you know what it really was they truly valued that kind of dirt under your fingernails perspective. I write about one of the interviews where I kind of threw it out there. I said, look, I don't have my PhD in foreign policy.
Right.
And they said, good, great. What you have, that's, we get plenty of academia in Washington, D.C. and think tanks and prognosticators. We want someone with dirt under their fingernails to tell us what is really going on. Again, well, you know, you can't just overstate what a bubble those policymakers are in and what's fed into them that gets kind of, you know, it can get really politicized. And to have someone to say, hey, I just talked to a battalion commander out on the ground. Here's the deal. Here's what's really happening. It's not going as well as you're being briefed.
Right.
It was something they really valued.
Did it bother you at all when you do all this work and the president tells you, well, we can't do it now because of politics and the way politics go in the game of politics, we're going to wait on this. We're going to pass it off to them. And oh, by the way, they may just, you know, shit can the whole thing and say, we're going in a completely different direction. Because in the Army, we're a little bit less diplomatic, right? We kind of just move things up the chain and we get blessings off. And when you get to that high at the chain, it's like, okay, well, I've reached the pinnacle. Like, I don't need approval from everybody else. This is the damn president. Like, do you get sense? Were you thinking at that point in time, like, oh God, what am I getting into?
Oh, it was beyond frustrating. Look, yeah, the great thing was, I mean, you know, in Vice President Cheney's office, even at this point, it was 07, 08, 09, you would have thought 9/11 had happened 6 months prior. I mean, they were absolutely focused. Number one job is to keep this country safe. No more 9/11s ever again, and hunting down Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. But at the same time, for example, we were shifting to European leadership in Afghanistan because we were so tied down in Iraq. And you know, trying doing that surge and trying to right that ship. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you know, we're watching us, you know, lose more and more and more and more of our gains in Afghanistan until that, you know, was a terrible situation. So yeah, it was incredibly frustrating. At that level, there's so much you have to balance. Obviously, the economy, domestic politics, the rest of the world, and even just getting kind of a slice of their time to really make a detailed case. The hardest thing was taking a 1,000-year-old problem and you get 30 seconds walking between the vice president's office and the sit room. You better nail your point, right? Yeah.
Brevity works.
Brevity was critical. You needed bottom line up front all day long. But it had its frustrations. But again, every day you pull up to work there, you kind of pinch yourself. I would take a deep breath and say, Waltz, don't screw it up, you know, and then head inside. So,
all right. So you head back in 2009 and you go to Afghanistan.
That's right.
It's interesting to hear you say that there was still this focus of no more 9/11s because, you know, that never felt like it. That's a feeling I think that citizens, you know, average citizens don't put in their head. Like military guys, we do, because I think we understand, you know, that was that was combat, right? That was a military operation on 9/11 mm-hmm. that was led against us by non-military guys, so to speak. But so we always have that thought in the back of our mind. That's what we're protecting. But I don't think civilians ever felt that. So when you're going to Afghanistan and you're still chasing down Osama bin Laden, like, is that part of your everyday thinking? Like, that's what you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, well, it certainly was for me. And obviously, I had a unique perspective. And when I say they were focused on no more 9/11s, right, that's TSA. That's the various FBI and getting DHS stood up as a whole new agency, the FBI authorities, the counterterrorism focus, like the National Counterterrorism System, just all of that infrastructure that I believe deserves credit for preventing another attack. And actually, there have been several dozen of 9/11 kind of style and intensity attacks that have been thwarted over the past 20 years. So it's not as though the bad guys stopped trying. They absolutely are. I mean, we remember the underwear bomber and bomber and all of those folks.
Yeah.
So that's one piece. So yes, I felt even you know, this point a decade later, that was still a critical part of our mission. Again, as a Green Beret, we go by with and through the locals. So we had Afghan Army and Afghan SWAT team and other militias that we were training. In fact, I had pushed for at the White House level authorization to begin training and arming local Afghan militias as long as we could have the teams out in the villages with them to keep an eye on them, and then went and stood up two of the first sites.
Oh,
so
wow.
I got the president to bless off on it and then went out there and actually did it and saw great success. Which would probably be another hour I could tell you about of really being in there in the villages with the locals, understanding who's wearing what jersey, you know, how they can play you and take advantage of you, mm-hmm. But helping them build up local tribal security.
So with foreign
tribes
internal
that
defense.
Wanted to work with us. Yeah. Exactly. But at a tribal level, not at, you know, with the Afghan army.
Yeah.
And
huge.
Doing both. So, but, you know, I think that was absolutely a mission still worth fighting. But at that point in 2009, we were doing it with a shoestring force. You know, after years of the focus being so heavily on Iraq, we ran into a bit of a buzzsaw. The other piece that was beyond frustrating was I had responsibility for four provinces in the border region. Here I am coming from the White House with my Lawrence of Arabia campaign plan. And the day I took over, Bo Bergdahl decided to go on his little walk in the desert.
Yeah.
And
this
everything,
is an interesting story.
Everything that I had planned got, I mean, kicked over like somebody kicking over a chessboard. Because everything, I mean, we got the order. Stan McChrystal was the general in charge. drop everything you're doing, whether it was facilitating the elections, going after Taliban commanders, going after Al-Qaeda, and find this kid. And, you know, look, we knew at the time he had stacked up his gear, stacked up his weapon, left it all behind, emailed his father denouncing America, and defected. He deliberately went over the bad guys. That story he has out there that he was just a little upset and kind of went on a walk is a bunch of garbage. He defected, went to the bad guys. And never in a million years did I think I would wake up, you know, years later and see him being hailed as a hero in the Rose Garden.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
That's a tough pill to swallow.
it was an incredibly tough pill to swallow. And actually, my first ever appearance on national television was the next day. I went on to Bret Baier's show on Fox News and said, "Time out, America. Put up your ticker tape parade. Not a hero that was rescued. This was a traitor that we just traded five of the Taliban's top draft picks that are going to go back to killing Americans." So that really tossed a massive monkey wrench into that next tour. But we fought through it, and eventually he was squirreled over the over the border and into Pakistan. Unfortunately,
I mean, how close were you guys to actually finding him?
Well, here was what was, just so devastating is the Taliban knew that we were pulling out all the stops to find this guy, and we're feeding false information into our informant networks and actively baiting us into ambushes. I had one team that I'll never forget. We have a code word that obviously I'm not going to share, but if you hear this, I don't care if you just found a pot of gold or, Miss America in the middle of the desert, like whatever, you stop what you're doing and get out because you're about to die. And heard that code word, and the Taliban had baited them into an ambush. The entire compound was rigged to explode. I would have lost a good couple of dozen Green Berets, and I don't even know how many Afghan soldiers had that thing gone off. Thank God it didn't. So, but the conventional unit next to us lost a number of soldiers. The number's debatable. I'm sticking with six because I've looked at all the cases. It really doesn't matter. The thing that can't be proved, but we all that were out there know happened, is how many soldiers across the theater didn't get the air support they needed, the medevac they needed, the intelligence support they needed, because it was all diverted to looking for him. So the opportunity cost was also very high.
Speaking of opportunity costs and high, as I mentioned earlier, you were at Camp Chapman on December 31st, 2009.
Right.
For those who are not familiar with that date, in the pursuit of bin Laden, there was a guy named Humam al-Balawi, who was a Jordanian doctor, who masqueraded himself. Originally, he was going to be a mole for the U.S., then he disappeared off the grid. And he shows back up, and he is set to treat the number two in Al-Qaeda. Correct me if I'm wrong here, by the way. And eventually might end up treating bin Laden. So in the pursuit to go get him, he wants to have a meeting with the CIA so they can vet him. But he will only do it in tribal territory. So Camp Chapman was chosen the place to do it. Long story short, they make arrangements for Balawi to work his way through security without being seen or frisked or stopped or security checked or whatever. He gets into the deepest part of Camp Chapman, and he is wearing a suicide vest inside a car, and he blows himself up and ends up killing, 13 or 14 total people in the most in the CIA in their history. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right, including the chief of base, Jim Matthews.
Okay, yeah. So just take me through what you're hearing leading up to this whole thing, and idea that you're getting closer to getting bin Laden. What's that like?
Well, that was such a highly compartmented operation. Perhaps one of my intelligence guys were and didn't tell me, but I certainly wasn't aware. I was literally just down the street where my headquarters was and saw the explosion, and saw the plume go up and knew it was on Camp Chapman, knew it was really bad. It turns out that it was actually on one of my bases. That was on Camp Chapman. I had moved. Remember, I told you earlier about moving the teams mm-hmm. into the villages to help to build up those tribal forces. I had moved my team off of their part of the base. They shared the compound with the agency, and the actual meeting went on our part of the base that was empty. And so I immediately knew where it had happened. I knew something was very bad. You know, the conventional unit landed a helicopter right there. It was one of the worst days. It was, the carnage was, I still get choked up talking about it, but it was terrible.
Did you know the meeting was taking place?
I didn't know the meeting was taking place. I had worked closely with Jen on a number of other operations with Jen Matthews. She was fantastic. I think what happened to her, kind of getting raked through the coals in the press afterwards, was really just awful and egregious. She was very sharp, very smart, knew what she was doing. And they made a tactical decision. We can debate it, but they made a decision that the risk of one of the kind of gate guards or somebody else spotting and compromising this guy outweighed, the risk of him being what turned out to be a double agent with a suicide vest on. And, they got us that day.
It's interesting you say that again, and I just want to share this for the civilians listening. There's two things that kind of we don't say enough on the podcast. You know, one, we talk about the gap between, you know, training and reality in combat, right? You train all you want, and then, you know, the reality of what actually happens on the ground is completely different. But yep. I can remember as well, sitting in the chow hall in Iraq in 2005 and 2006 when I was there, and watching how the news was reported, and literally looking up at the TV and just hitting my buddy next to me going, dude, they're bleeping lying. Like, this is like not even remotely close to anything that is factual of what is going on here. And yet,
yeah,
you know, this is the world we live in, where news and headlines and things that sell and ratings and all the other stuff that have nothing to do with what we actually do on the ground.
And agendas by general.
Yes. I mean,
it is. Right?
And it's worse now than it was back then. But, you know, to that point, when I hear you say that, you know, a CIA, you know, case agent was raked over the coals for a tactical decision that nobody in Washington had anything, you know, it really doesn't affect them, right? They can put their opinion in, but at the end of the day, they're not on the ground. And it's those kind of things that sort of chap my backside, because I'm just like, you know, you have to understand the life that you're leading over there every single day. And that factors into your decision more than what people 100,000 miles away are thinking.
Yeah, look, this was, I mean, you know, in retrospect, we know now this was a source that everyone back in Washington, everyone was excited about. We thought we might finally have a real bead on Zawahiri and bin Laden, and we just needed to get that final kind of eyes on and confirmation. They got us. They fed us a line, and she made that decision to avoid any chance of compromising that source. And, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but I just want to say, absolutely for the record, we had a fantastic working relationship with her and with her team. And to your point, you know, when you're wearing uniform, you get the thank yous for your service, you get the medals, right? I mean, it's a very visible display of our service. Those, you know, diplomats and our intelligence professionals that are out there day in and day out, often in a lot of the same harm's way, just, you know, they serve in silence. Mm-hmm. And their families often suffer in silence. And I just want to give them just a tremendous shout out for everything they do to keep us safe.
And yeah, no, by the way, if they ever get an award, they take it right back, because you can never let anybody know you had it. So yeah, welcome to thank you in a different language.
That's right.
One more note on this, and that's, when finally we did get bin Laden, did you feel a sense of sort of, you know, not vindication, but, you know, hey, Jennifer didn't die in vain sort of deal?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was one of the lead targets. She was, you know, to that documentary that you mentioned, The Hunt for Bin Laden, there was a small group, almost all of them women, by happenstance, that had been hunting, studying, following him for over a decade, since the 90s.
Yeah.
And so it was not just vindication for her, but so many others that were seeking vindication for the 3,000 Americans that were killed on 9/11 and their families.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Google Alex Station, A-L-E-C, Alex Station. You'll get a lot of information there. All right, so how do we transition into elected office? When and how does this happen? Do you decide that this is what you want to do, or is sort of it's, you know, one of those things that hits you in the face?
Well, I came back this next time, having worked for, you know, after that tour, having worked for Dick Cheney. I wasn't exactly invited into the Biden office or the Obama administration. So it was time to find something else to do on the civilian side. I knew that I wanted to go into the private sector. I was always, I guess maybe it was the Green Beret in me where they drop you off in the middle of nowhere yep. and tell you to figure it out. To be an entrepreneur, I joined a company that had just formed. And we started with three of us in an attic, literally, in a very small investment that quickly ran out. And we ended up building it up to about 400 employees, private equity backed, Inc. 500, 5 years in a row in terms of fastest growing companies in America. Before I stepped down as CEO to run for office, which is probably the stupidest thing financially I will ever do. But, you know, I have these skill sets that God's blessed me with in terms of I've walked the walk in combat, in the White House, in the Pentagon, now in the private sector, understanding what it means to sign the front of a paycheck and take those kind of risks, to create an environment with growth, to be in an environment where government I found was in my way. From growing and creating more jobs as much as it was helping. And I decided, you know, I can, you know, commentate on television as a Fox contributor, or I can roll up my sleeves and be part of our republic and be part of our solution. So so when then Congressman DeSantis decided to go run to be the governor of Florida and the seat opened, I said, what the hell? Let's take a swing at it. And we ended up winning. Now I'm just running for re-election after my first term. And I have to tell you, you know, I mean, you appreciate spending a life of noble service defending this republic. Now to be a part of it, to walk up those Capitol steps is a real honor. But there are definitely days where I think Afghanistan's easier than yeah. Washington, D.C. right now.
I was going to ask you, what's more of a contact sport, becoming a Green Beret yeah. or politics yeah. every day?
Yeah. I mean, look, I tell my team all the time, everybody settle down. Nobody's shooting at us or blowing us up,
right.
literally.
Mm-hmm.
It might be figuratively, but keep it all in perspective. And I think that's what military service does for you, is gives you not just perspective on what real stress is, but on how great this country is. And I tell people all the time, you think this country's so bad? Let me take you over to West Africa. Let me take you over, because I've also served in Niger and Nigeria and Senegal and other places. Or let me take you over to Afghanistan and you'll be kissing the ground. We're not a perfect country, but I do not buy into this. We are fundamentally, you know, misogynistic or fundamentally racist or fundamentally just, you know, a force for bad in the world. I think we are an exceptional nation that always can stand to be improved.
What's the one trait that a Green Beret has that translates best to being a congressman?
Oh, God, that's a great question. You know, I would say adaptability and being able to kind of, this may surprise you, but I would say being able to empathize.
Yeah.
And the adaptability, it's literally on any given day, I'm dealing with water and environmental issues, transportation, Russian submarines, space, e-cigarettes, medicinal marijuana. I mean, just affordable housing across the board. And you have to be able to get to the core of the issue, ask the right questions, because you just can't be an expert on everything, and be rooted in some type of governing philosophy and values that is going to be kind of your guiding, your compass through all of those issues. And then on the empathy is never losing sight of the fact that you're a servant leader and you should be a servant leader. We always, I think good commanders, when they take command, basically take the approach of you work for the soldiers. You're there for them. And for me now representing nearly a million Americans, they're the boss. It's their money. They've entrusted me to vote on their behalf and to spend that money for the good of the country. But at the end of the day, I take we the people very seriously. And I think those things, you know, so far, so good.
Because the military is so much of a meritocracy, if you will, right? Like, mm-hmm. ideally, the best people get promoted, the best people get the hardest jobs and lead going forward. You know, you're in this world of politics where outside looking in, it almost seems counter to that. Do you find yourself struggling with that at times?
Sometimes. I think anybody would struggle with that sometimes. But, what's unique here is, you would appreciate this, as being a reservist, being a National Guardsman, and having your foot in the civilian world and in the military world, so you don't get kind of too locked into one mindset. But you know, things you have to appreciate in politics is relationships matter,
yeah.
and they matter a lot. And sometimes they matter more than merit. And I think that's just, part of that's just human nature. Look, is the place a swamp? Absolutely. Is it replete with interest? Yes. Do people, love to beat up on lobbyists? Absolutely. Until they're lobbying for something that you really care about, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's the environment or, pro-life or, a new highway for your neighbor, outside of your neighborhood. So, look, I kind of go back to Winston Churchill's famous saying, which is American democracy is the worst system of government in the world, except all the others, right? So, I am an optimist on the resiliency of this country, and every day that I'm in it, I have that much more of appreciation for kind of this brilliant kind of framework that our founding fathers put in place.
Well, you did foreign internal defense. Now you're doing political internal defense. It's all about hearts and minds, right? Every day.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Congressman, listen, I know your time is precious. So I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And certainly, having the best interests of America at heart and whatever political side people are on. I don't think that's what this podcast or what this discussion is about, but certainly you can hear that patriotism, that still love for America coming through. So I genuinely thank you for your time.
Well, thanks, Mark. If I could just add one more thing,
absolutely.
That I do think that will absolutely move this country forward and bring it back together in ways that are so important. It's twofold. One is more veterans in our political system. One of the stats that really motivated me was the fact that in the late 70s, 74% of the House and the Senate were vets. You know what it is today? 18%.
Wow, I was going to say under 20.
Record low, yeah, record low. And that's actually an increase in the last few years. Record low in our nation's history. Why does that matter so much? It's not necessarily that we will agree on every issue. I co-founded a veterans caucus called For Country. Republican and Democrat, we disagree on all kinds of things, but it's the ethos that we bring. It's that mission focus because, as you know, in the foxhole, on the plane, on the ship, nobody cares about black, white, and brown. It's just red, white, and blue, right? It's about mission. It's about country. No, certainly no one cares about political party. It's about getting the job done for this nation. That's one piece. And then I think a broader societal piece is getting us back to national service. I just spent actually this morning with a 100-year-old World War II veteran who was a fighter pilot over Normandy. And it's getting us back to a lot of that ethos of the greatest generation, where at 18 years old, you learned leadership, followership, teamwork, and you did it with people that don't look like you, whether you're a, black kid from the inner city, white kid, farm boy from, wherever, Indiana, Jewish kid from Brooklyn, whatever, you were all forced together. And if you couldn't overcome your differences, you had a drill sergeant's boot in your rear end to help you mm-hmm. get there. And then you went back into society. And when I say national service, that's not necessarily in uniform. That can be inner city tutoring, national parks, Peace Corps, FEMA volunteer corps, whatever. But, get out there, serve your community, serve your neighbor, serve your country again, learn those life skills. And I think, and do it with people that don't look or act or have the same background as you. If we get back to that, I think we will be a far better nation for it, overcome a lot of these divides. I have legislation that's been introduced and is gaining support to get us there.
Perfectly said. Congressman Michael Waltz, thank you for being part of the Hazard Ground.
God bless, brother.
You've been listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, hosted by Mark Zeno and produced by Matt Pascarella. If you have an interesting story to tell and you'd like to be on the show, send us an email at hazardgroundpodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the show, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.